Hello, my name is Hayden Thompson and welcome to the Pack Heavy Podcast. Now, this show is really for anyone in the hospitality and food manufacturing industries that uses flexible packaging to get their products to market. Here, I'll be talking about everything food packaging and providing you with the information and knowledge that you need to get the right food package into your hands and into the hands of your consumer. I'm really excited to be interviewing guests just like you who have traveled the path that you're on so that you can learn from their successes and failures and engage in the mindset required to go all in on your vision. Now, I personally call this mindset the pack heavy mentality, and it is driven by deliberate actions such as making the decision to go all in on your vision for your business. So I'm talking about gathering market intelligence, putting a strong plan in place, organizing the appropriate resources, and then executing on your strategy with precision. So if you're packing heavy on your vision, you're definitely in the right place, and I'm really excited to have you here. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to episode number 11 of the Pack Heavy Podcast. On today's episode, I'm excited to have Rick Zabojski, VP of Business Development at Dover Specialty Foods, along with me today. Now, Dover cut its teeth in the industry as an ethnic Norwegian food supplier, and over 60 years later has further developed its reach into the specialty food world, not only servicing grocery and retail, but also selling directly into the food service industry. Now, Rick has an amazing amount of experience in sales and marketing leadership and management, and is here today to discuss the value that working with a CPG distributor can bring to your business. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Thank you, Hayden. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you're welcome. Mate, I was excited to have you onto the show and have a conversation with you today because our listeners, if you can imagine, a lot of people that are either starting out, they've been selling direct to the consumer or they've been selling online through that channel, or it's a restaurant or a cafe and they've pivoted into new spaces. So whether it's prepackaged foods or pre-prepared meals, you know, they're really looking to expand into retail. So I thought it'd be a valuable conversation that you and I can have regarding what it means to work with a distributor that can help people access the retail and grocery world.
No doubt, it will be.
Yeah, so that's where the majority of your experience lies. So just take us back a little bit before your days at Dover.
Wow, I don't know how far back you want to go. It's a birthday week for me, which will be 55, so I won't go back quite
Happy
that
birthday.
Far. Oh, thanks. I won't go quite back quite that far, but I think my foray into the CPG world, into sales and marketing, really started with a Gillette company, specifically on the oral care side, working for Oral-B. As I worked in that organization, I eventually transferred out of the professional oral care division over to work for Gillette Canada, I started to call on Overweighty, is what they were called back then, not Save-On Foods, as a key account manager, working with planograms, being customer captain, different categories, and at that point I realized that, of all the businesses I had done in the past, working in the packaged goods industry was the most rewarding as a salesperson. And I just decided that that was where I was going to stay and worked there for a while. And as you know, Gillette was sold to P&G, and there were options on the table for most of us to stay or to go. For better or for worse, I decided to go. I had an opportunity to go to stay, but that would have been back in the professional healthcare division. And it wasn't really where my heart was. My heart really was in retail and in the packaged goods world. So I left and I found myself recruited by Concord National, which is a broker here, which most people probably know, and worked there as a business development manager for, maybe 4 years or so. And learned a lot going from manufacturer to broker. There's a definite change in hats, and it was good to see how brokers think about the business working with their suppliers and taking their business to the trade. I was then recruited 4.5 years later by Dover Import, which is now called Dover Specialty Foods, and we've just rebranded. And that was a distributor, and I knew nothing about distribution. The only thing I knew was at a Rexall show I did a long time ago when they used to have them. And it was a PharmaSave buying show, years and years ago back at Gillette. I remember asking one of the other key account managers, what's that company over there with 10,000 things on their on their in their booth. He says, "Oh, they're a distributor. You never want to work for a distributor." And I thought to myself, "No kidding, you know, it's death or success by 10,000 transactions." And so, here I am, 10 years later, still with Dover Specialty Sales, rebranding, it's been probably one of the most rewarding parts of my career to date.
Mm. And what do you put down the rewarding aspect to? Is it the fact that you are working with so many different, you know, businesses? Is it the fact that you're, you know, it's a relationship sort of business as well? Like, what do you put it down to?
Those things are definitely on the list. I think that working for a distributor, you gain, a lot of insight into not only your supplier, hence manufacturer. So if you're a small startup in the Valley or up in Whistler making something, or you're an already ongoing international enterprise, distribution, route to market is the cornerstone of business. And, you know, and you learn a little bit about suppliers, or, you know, and then you learn a lot about brokers as well, if you weren't one. So the folks that manage brands for us, they work with brokers and they work directly with suppliers. And then we have people that work with customers. So you really are in the middle of it all. It really does complement all aspects. What I like about the evolution of our business is that we're not just wheeling in goods to the back receiving area of said customer and saying, "There you go." We're actually involved at the outset with organizations in terms of, you know, how are we going to take your product to market? What are those markets? Where are those markets for you? How are you going to grow? So we're involved in all steps of the business. So you could say, and I'm not sure if it's going to go over well, but we act as broker a lot of the time. Now, that doesn't mean we act as broker in the traditional model that we are managing a simple head office, not simple, but we are simply managing a head office relationship and your products being shipped from your warehouse to the customer's warehouse. But in essence, we do that, but on a small part of it. But we really are the buy sell of any business. And in our perspective, we become you, the manufacturer's biggest fan and biggest customer.
Mm. No, that is cool.
Develop your plan for market. Yeah.
Well, that was one question that I had, because there always does seem to be a little bit of ambiguity around what does it mean to be a distributor and what exactly is a broker and the different roles that they play. So could you just try and, like, top level, try and break it down for us?
Break it down. Okay. Yeah. So on the broker side,
yeah.
The broker never really owns the inventory. They are facilitating or brokering an agreement between said supplier and said customer, and they'll earn a commission by doing that, and they'll manage that trade relationship for the supplier. So whether you're in our backyard in Vancouver or you're coming from Miami and your product is being shipped to a customer in Canada, the broker is responsible for presenting and maintaining and developing your brand within the market. The distributor also has some parallel capability. So I may choose to work directly with that manufacturer in Miami, but rather than have them ship the goods direct to customer, I buy all their inventory, right? So our supply chain department, everything comes to our warehouse. But before it does, obviously we've negotiated a few things, but we basically act then as your sales agent to head offices, which is what the broker would do, plus other arenas like food service that you mentioned at the outset there, or the specialty independent retailer, or the convenience and gas channel, or whatever the market is deemed to be.
So really you're providing reach that you would otherwise have to work very, very hard to achieve.
I think so. Definitely. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So when you sit down with a prospective client, like, or a prospective supplier, what it is exactly that you're looking for in them, like, to build a relationship upon, or how do you, what's your decision-making process to onboard somebody?
Well, it's gotten a lot harder for people to get listed, not only with us, but I'm pretty sure with every distributor that I talk to. There's just so much new product on the horizon all the time. And even with brokers, I know, speaking with one earlier this week, on some business we're looking at, they turned down so many opportunities and really, you know, transition one or two into the next step. But specifically for us, it's a process that starts, whether we initiate it or someone else does, it's the same after that first conversation. There is a conversation, a bit of a vetting process that involves understanding all the components of their brand and, you know, where they are, how it gets here, what category it falls into, what's happening in that category today. Do we have capacity to take that on? And their ability to manage trade marketing requirements, et cetera. Mm. And so there's a lot of paperwork involved. There's cost management involved, and there's strategy around shelf price involved and target market sort of conversations.
Mm. I think that's one piece as well, sort of the mechanics of the relationship. So sort of break down what the typical margins are that need to be considered, you know, when building out the product and building out the distribution chain all the way through to the consumer level pricing. So like what kind of margins is everybody expecting to take along the way? And does that sort of differ from industry to industry or channel to channel?
Well, I, you know what, I'll speak just towards the grocery channel. Mm. I can tell you that if we're really gearing this conversation for folks who are just sort of starting out, and yeah. we have a couple in transition today who have been at, who have a terrific product. They've been at the farmer's market. They may have knocked on the door at Whole Foods and said, I'm local and Whole Foods brings them in. And I wish there was a form or an opportunity, and maybe there is, and I haven't explored it, where organizations like mine and potentially yours through this episode could say, before you graduate from the farmer's market, understand the margin requirement in order to understand what your shelf price is going to be ultimately when you find yourself at a major grocery store. And so part of it for us is if it's a local product, it depends, is it fresh, frozen, or shelf stable, right? And also depends on our grocers' requirements in terms of, we sort of know that, you know, your typical retailer margin will be anywhere from 35 to 50%, depending on the banner and the specialty nature of the product. And if you take a look at a distributor, they're going to want anywhere between 20 and 30% on average, depending on fresh, frozen, shelf stable, et cetera, to factor into that. For us, as well as other importers, there's things like freight and currency, which also add to that sort of mix. So if you are making your product, say, in the Valley, and you've made a new barbecue sauce, and you know that, if you know those things and you set your wholesale price up correctly, you don't end up with a shelf price of $9.99, even though it might be the best barbecue sauce in the world, no one's going to buy it.
Price yourself out of the market. Yeah.
Every time. And so our, you know, a key function of our vetting process to is to make sure that the folks who are bringing the product to us have a clear understanding of their competitors and their shelf price. We will do some retail reconnaissance with or for them. And then we will work on a shelf strategy.
Mm. I think that's really valuable information to have, isn't it? So when you're going out there and you're doing some research specifically for this potential new business that you're bringing on, for example, and you're having the discussions about long-term strategies that you can co-develop together, how does that conversation happen? Like, how far into the future are you looking? And are you able to sort of provide analytics or data or insights for people to sort of draw upon to sort of leverage within their business as well? And I'm assuming it's going to be beneficial. It's going to be a two-way communication there. It's going to bring benefit to both parties.
Yeah, lots to unpack there. So I'll start with the, you know, the vision for the time horizon. And I think that the conversation that, you know, we have with most new entrants into the marketplace, I think we have to pick those as sort of the basis for this answer versus an established brand yeah. that already gets it. But for those that are new, you know, it's an investment. It's an investment in time. And I haven't met any manufacturer that wants to be in the business for 18 months. Now, I like to let them know we take the exact same approach for every brand they go through, how they land in our company and work through our company till we're actually delivering a product to the store. Everybody goes through it. And we do the same thing at retail that we've done for 60 years. And then if, you know, so I think that it really comes down to the manufacturer's ability to fund their business. You know, that is really one of the key foundations. I've never met, and we never expect as we develop a ton of local brands, that someone's able to come to the table with a suitcase full of trade spend and say, I need to be everywhere by tomorrow. That doesn't happen. So recognizing that the brand can get into a couple of key locations while it builds its sort of reputation, creates innovation, and accrues for spend for the next big opportunity, and away you go. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think a different question to that would be, how long do you guys look at a brand before you say this isn't working? Because that's usually two paths. Something's going to happen, which that's obvious, and then something doesn't happen. And it's really difficult when brands, we would list a new brand, and within a year it's caught up to the competitors, you know, in the marketplace, and something else was listed and it's so far behind, it's sort of painful. And there's really only so many things that we can bring to the, I guess, to the conversation in terms of how we can rectify that situation.
Yeah, and no, hence, totally.
That's why a lot of brands over the years, you will see, have worked through different brokers and or worked through different distributors, because maybe the something in the relationship isn't right. But I think it always stems back to, I haven't met any brokers that I don't think are very good, and I haven't met any distributors that aren't great either. I would say all companies have great people and they're all good at their job. So it comes back to the marketing mix, right? You know, so what's going on in the marketing mix that's inhibiting that product from moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, there's a time and a place for every product out there as well. And some products just take off because of really good, timing in general. All right, so that's step one. You've onboarded a product. You've had the conversation around what the future looks like. Tell me a little bit more about the mechanics of how the relationship works. So, for example, like warehousing and cross-docking and transport and delivery and sort of those components.
So are you asking, so we've got the products in our warehouse?
Yeah, you've listed. So now, okay. Obviously, you've gone out there and you've had the conversation with the retailers and they've decided to list your product on the shelf as well. And now you need to actually get the product into your warehouse and distribute it out into the world. So how does that look? What does that look like?
Well, what that looks like is at that point, we already understand what the freight component and currency component potentially look like.
Yep.
And lead time. And so we know what our landed costs are, and we've already decided on what the wholesale case price is going to be to the trade and established the SRP. So at that point, it really is... the fastest part of the process, in terms of we're basically purchasing goods, and whether they're FOBs or not, the goods are on the way. When they land, what I like to do is, or just before they land, is have the supplier online currently with our team via Zoom. We introduce them to our team. So they may have met myself, someone in accounting, maybe someone in purchasing, but they meet our marketing team and they meet our territory management team and they meet our key account people.
Yeah.
And they get welcomed into the Dover family, as we like to say. And they understand that we have, your goods are arriving, and these are the marketing materials we're taking to these accounts, and away we go. Typically though, I would tell you that 95% of the time, Hayden, we will find a customer first before we purchase the goods. Once in a while, someone comes back from a trade mission with an order in hand that they've ordered pallets of popcorn or something without a customer. Sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, but we try to do our due diligence to say we have found the perfect customer to launch your business with, and that would be a major customer in order to do that.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. That approach is typical of the entrepreneurial mindset, isn't it? Like, always know who your customer is, always try and sell before you've actually got stock in.
Well, you see, it's different. You know, if I was a broker, I might be charging some sort of fee every month in order to perform duties for you while I go to try to find a home for your business.
Yeah.
However, with us, if I have 150 brands and I've bought them all, I don't have a single home and it's going to take 6 months. Well, it's very difficult. So we 95% of the time, we already have a customer who's interested. So there's a little bit of marketing done in the background to say, so when goods are on their way here, there's already an order in the system for one of our major customers, and we develop the market beyond that.
Yeah.
So it takes a little bit of risk out of the equation.
Yeah. And that would be considered, is that considered a pipeline fill? Is that the language that you'd use?
You could call it a pipeline fill, you know, but I would definitely, yeah, you can call it a pipeline fill, because to me, I've got the goods that are going into the customer who's already ordered, plus I need inventory for the balance of the market.
Got you. Okay, yeah. No worries. So obviously, it sounds amazing that you've already got the sales and marketing team out there doing a lot of the legwork for this business as well. So what kind of reach do you, a typical distributor have out in the world? Like, are you guys just focusing on the Lower Mainland and all of the major banners, or how does that work?
A reach? Yeah.
Yeah.
For us? Yeah. Well, we would like to think that, you know, well, obviously our specialty is British Columbia, but we do operate in Alberta. In the Yukon, we have a few customers, and we have customers in Saskatchewan as well, Federated Co-op. And we have a few customers remaining in Ontario that are changing simply due to the dynamics of freight. And freight has become an enormous component of our business. And it, what it does do is make, you know, goods, it just makes it impossible to do business that far away directly. So Dover Specialty Foods is part of an association of other distributors across the country that we can move inventory around a little easier, and brands have opportunities to participate in markets like Ontario, Quebec, and Atlantic Canada through that. Doesn't mean that because I've listed something, the individual in Atlantic Canada is guaranteed to take it. They may not, they may do it. And I think that there are a lot of distributors that have those partnerships across the country, unless you're one of the two larger organizations that already have that infrastructure.
Yeah, got you. Yeah. So how has the industry changed over the years? So I know we've just been impacted by COVID, and I can imagine there could have been a bit of a shift in the industry and in the way that the market behaves and so on. What are the biggest changes that you've seen sort of over the last 5 years and more recently?
Well, I'll just talk about more recently first. Yeah. I'm really impressed with our industry's resilience. I know that, you know, if food's necessary, and that most food companies should have seen some success during COVID. That's not a, doesn't mean to sound that way, that you're successful due to a pandemic, but it's just the necessity of food. And I know it's changed the grocery store dynamic in terms of expectation and volume. And, you know, for us, our supply chain at the outset was, you know, scrambling to get containers from Europe. There's all kinds of domino effect challenges that really impacted our business. And if you have fresh product, that impacted your business. If you're in like an olive bar situation, that impacted your business. And so it really forced us to revisit what we're doing very quickly and pivot. I know that's a word that's used a little too much. I don't think I'll use it again on this podcast. In fact, I'm not going to ever say it again, but I don't really like it. But so I am just impressed by, the relationships that we have. Our team's very tenured. They've been at it a long time, and we are able to do business on the phone, via Zoom, via email, maintain our current business level, and actually meet the new demand that the pandemic had placed upon us and most other food companies in general. I think that the grocery stores also have done an amazing job, you know, transitioning to how the new model works with all their suppliers. I mean, they need suppliers, and their, you know, message has been loud and clear. We need inventory, and, you know, do all that you can to get it here. And so every organization was working and is working to get that done. So I think that in the future, post this pandemic, there's going to be a bit of a shift, because we've proven that you don't necessarily need to have the playbook that you had pre-pandemic in terms of, well, Hayden and Rick, we've got to get out there and we've got to, you know, see people personally all day long. I think the world has shifted that I don't really need to physically see you, whether it's a new item or an existing item, as long as we've got that relationship. So I think that's changed. What's changed in the last 5 years? Well, I can attest to the growth of specialty foods as an arena that has just, you know, skyrocketed. Everybody, even the most diehard, you know, Calgary Flames fan, I have a friend in Calgary who only eats hot dogs. He's looking for organic food now. So that is changing. So specialty better for you products are definitely, you know, surging ahead. There's absolutely, I don't see any limit on that.
Well, that's a conversation that we have with a lot of our clients as well that are packaging up their food. Like everybody's sort of got the angle of, you know, organic, natural, categories that they're trying to enter into as well. So yeah, we're definitely noticing that change too.
Yeah. You know what? And the certifying bodies have gotten easier to work with a long time ago. If it was Marine Steward Council, it took a long time to get an inspection and to do this. Now it's getting a lot easier for these companies to get the certification that they think is valuable for their product, which helps them stand out on shelf.
Yeah. So just going back to your young days when you were a salesman pounding the pavement, I remember you and I sat down quite some time ago and, you know, we were having a discussion about the way that sales were, the way that sales were conducted in the grocery world. Mm-hmm. And it was amazing, you know, it was going in and actually with a pen and pencil and, you know, filling orders. So with the change, obviously, and you just mentioned that a lot of people are working from home. So have those sort of patterns changed as well for your sales team?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, maybe even before, way back before that, if you were a salesperson in the 80s and 90s, you would stop at a hotel and use the lobby phone to call in your order while you had a coffee, right? So those, because we didn't have phones. So, geez, that's going way back. I'm sounding old now. And before that, we used a hammer and chisel and a stone tablet. We just carved the order out. There it is. Yes. And, but you know what? I think technology, because you touched on data earlier on and what that means to big business and small business alike, technology has been a real savior for us, and we've invested extensively in it. And, you know, order management system has to be, you know, friendly. And has to be, you know, something that everyone is an expert at. Our side, our team is certainly equipped with technology in order to place orders and see real-time inventory. And, you know, it's not perfect. There are some glitches and some surprises, because at the end of the day, Hayden, the data has to still be input by a human being somewhere. And so one side of the equal sign doesn't always equal the other. But most of the time it does, and we're improving. One of the things that we've done as well is, you know, try to mirror organizations that, you know, we think are fantastic and are doing all the right things. And that is just really getting data for the business managers in our, you know, inside our company, understanding so many more metrics now that we have the capability to do that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot we can offer suppliers in terms of what's gone on for them, and projections of where they could be so they can scale, right? So they can consider how they're going to, you know, get to the next step. We try to arm them with as much information as possible.
It's interesting, isn't it? So there are so many different distribution models out there, whether it's in the food industry like you are, or whether it's the automotive industry or the packaging industry like what I'm in. Mm-hmm. Who seems to be leading the way in terms of like change and technology and so on? And where does the food industry's distribution model sort of, what does that mirror? Or what does it follow? Or is it a leader in the industry out there?
That's a great question. And I really don't know if we're a leader, if the food industry is a leader. I think that packaged good industry has always been a leader in information.
Yeah.
If you take a look at organizations like SPINS and AC Nielsen, as far back as I can go, understanding what's happening with consumers around a brand has been at the cornerstone of new brand development and innovation and category opportunity. And I think that those agencies providing that service are one part of the equation and are a great partner. I'm not sure if other industries look at that. Colleagues that might work in finance, I think there's information, but there's no standard information. Some, there is some, but then there isn't. So yeah. I guess it really, it becomes, you know, I guess it's competitive like anything else, but I think that organizations in our industry that have access to that data, use it, realize that they can mirror that for themselves in terms of what they want to invest in and what they want to measure. And I think that for Dover, if I go back 60 years ago, where Armin and his dad had a small little shop in East Vancouver to where we are today, it's just like, it's a fantastic transition, and it's an amazing story of, you know, just importing some Scandinavian goods for the neighborhood and a van and a forklift and two or three employees to where we're at today.
Yeah. Yeah. No, totally.
And, but, you know, I also think that what's really changed in our industry, what the data has done is it has made everybody a little more wise that's involved in the process. So if I've given you better information, you can make a better decision. So your suppliers know more. You know, because so many folks are like, I don't understand how it works at the Georgia Main Group. And you know, so, and so, so I think that it's having the information available for everybody just, you know, ups the overall benefit for everybody.
Yeah,
no, to make better decisions.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I guess as soon as you've got the data, you can draw on that data to make the decisions, as you were saying. All around the world, there's grocery, right? Now, there's got to be nuance to the way that it is operated and the distribution channels all around the world and how they operate their little, you know, pockets of the industry. We were just talking, or I just asked the question around, like, are there other industries that the grocery or the food industry sort of mirrors? Who's leading the way around the world? Sort of like, where's all of the innovation happening? Is it in Europe, or is it in sort of the down in the States, or where, who's leading? And, you know, where does everybody sort of look to for sort of that industry change when it happens?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I'm not an expert on our industry in general, nor outside of North America.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, I think that definitely in Europe, some of the established grocery chains over there certainly, you know, have, you know, led the way in terms of innovation, in terms of messaging consumers or their customers and loyalty programs and how the stores are laid out, which would potentially change the way goods get to their business.
Yeah.
I know, you know, here we, I couldn't tell you who's really leading the way. I think that I've not seen anything outside of technology, really, in terms of just data for the business. That's really what it sort of lands on. I haven't seen innovation like SpaceX type of innovation in the CPG industry. You know, it's like, wow, this is fantastic. We can just beam over your order and there's no freight. That's not happening.
Yeah,
I think the big grocery stores, they lend ideas to how they operate and how they measure and what they look for. They help companies like ours be better at what we do. And that translates into the same message we offer suppliers. These are the things you need to be thinking about end game.
Yeah.
So we take our cues really from our customers and really turn that into a workable situation for our suppliers.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, I'm thinking more of like the just-in-time sort of like ordering systems and, you know, where people just need it like within, you know, the next day. Is that something that's possible in this day and age? As you know, it really depends on the manufacturer and what their capabilities and, you know, scalability is like as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think, you know, that is a term that you hear once in a while, but I think it's really unique to the organization itself.
Yeah.
And if you're a really big company, then those types of metrics are super important for inventory management. But again, going back to, you know, the folks that are getting into the business.
Yeah.
Whether you're doing $1 million in sales and you're still growing, or you're just starting out and you hope to do, you know, $10,000 in sort of grocery sales this year, because you've done a little bit of farmer's market yourself. The bottom line is, you know, from a distributor's perspective, I'm going to buy your goods and they're going to live in my warehouse, which is there's a demand for space. And so those folks are letting me know there's not room, there is room, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I have to convince them why we're bringing this in. And I have to have done a good job with the supplier to say, this is the expectation of your business. And then they understand this is what I need to provide the distributor.
Fantastic. So
it's really fluid that way. We don't have any hard metrics and we don't really work in that system per se.
Yeah, got you. Mm-hmm. So let's go back. So in terms of general advice, so what are some common mistakes or miscalculations that you notice brands make when entering into the retail space? Are there any sort of anything that you can sort of highlight that you've noticed over the years?
Mm-hmm. I don't want to single anybody out.
But no, not at all.
I'm just flooded with examples.
Yeah, I get you.
I think it goes back to something I said earlier, Hayden, that if you are pioneering a product in your kitchen and your friends and family tell you that it's great, that's not really necessarily true till you understand how it's going to, you know, face up on a grocery store shelf and what the everyday retail price is going to be.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I give a lot of credit to those local brands and startups that we're working with today and have had the chance to work with. There's a lot that they have to do just in their own arena. And I find that, you know, myself or anybody else that works with these folks on the brand development side get a lot of benefit from sharing what the right steps are. And 99% of the time, it's price.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really my job to tell you that your package is crazy.
Yep.
But I will tell you if it won't fit on a shelf, if it's packed in a weird number, like there's 17 in a case, nobody wants that either.
Mm-hmm.
So people do stuff because they got cardboard from their cousin, Mike, who happens to have extra cardboard cases because startup, right?
Yeah.
So everything from package to price to promotion to product, we obviously try it ourselves. It's difficult though. I know as a salesperson, I never like to get a no from someone because they didn't eat sardines. That's not their decision to make for the buying population, is it? Right?
No.
Consumers. So you know that as well as I do. But at the end of the day, it can be really simple. And we try to use our literature and we try to make our literature real easy for brands to sort of follow the path from start to finish about how this process is going to go. And with that, with those forms, the discussions are had, and we really will call out things that I just don't think a $17 peanut butter is going to work in our market, you know? So even though that they're your grandma's peanuts, doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, yeah. I hear you. Yeah. So bad recommendations that you hear in your professional area of expertise. Mm-hmm. So there are so many voices out there as well. Are there any bad recommendations that you hear?
Bad recommendations. Give me an example of what
I'm just trying to think of it as well. So let me see. So, you know, we've just discussed, and you know what, there's something that I highlight. I've spoken a bit about this on the podcast as well. I sort of call it the pack heavy mentality. So somebody has done all of the upfront research. And I think that having a conversation with a business like yours prior to even having the thought of entering into the retail space, and they're like, all right, what's the homework that I need to do, like, prior to getting in? And you just mentioned like case counts and, you know, packaging size and weights and so on, like what's the industry standard? And I think that they can probably learn a lot by just walking through the grocery aisles and evaluating where their competitors are currently sitting and how their package looks on the shelf sitting next to a package next to their competitors and so on, price points and so on. But like, if you open up the curtain, there's a lot behind there as well into the world that you just don't have any insights on. And I'm thinking about there are buyback plans, or what would you call that? What's the language regarding, you know, stock that goes out of date and you have to buy all of that back? And, you know, there are programs that you have to, you have to buy into, programs so that your product is discounted for certain periods of the year. So, I mean, I'm not using all of the right language because I'm not specifically familiar with it, but if you could give a little bit of insight into that part of the world and how that operates. And then any bad advice sort of that people have given over the years that you've been like, oh, I wouldn't have taken that advice.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack there.
I know.
Wow.
Let's take it one step at a time.
You said
Sorry,
it was going to be one question at a time on your podcast, but holy cow. So to address the first part.
Yeah.
Can you reframe that a little bit?
Yeah. So when people are, you know, they're going out there and then considering going into the retail world on the grocery shelf, you know, there's a lot of homework that they need to do before they even have a conversation with somebody like yourself. You know, you want people to come with a certain element or a certain amount of information or a certain understanding of what they're currently going to, what they're about to embark on and what they're getting into. Where can they go, or where can they go to A, find that information before they have a conversation with you? Like, are there any specific places? And then, you know, let's just start there.
Yeah, I think there are, I have heard but not participated yeah. in industry forums.
Yeah.
As an example, I was in attendance at one for Sobeys, Thrifty yeah. Foods local program, where yeah. Folks from the grocery store were answering questions in a panel format to people in that room who had new brands that they wanted to get into the local program with Thrifty Foods. And it seems to be a lot of the same questions. Mm. And you know, you're like, yeah, those are good questions to ask. And the things that you said about, I've gone out and looked around, I have a pretty good idea that, hey, if I'm making a new cereal or a new energy bar, this is kind of what they look like, how they merchandise, what prices are. Mm. Again, thinking of an energy bar company I looked at that would have been, you know, at a 40, 50% premium to the most expensive bar on the shelf because of the ingredients. And it's never mm. my job to say your bar is just too good. You know, and so we won't do a good job for you is kind of where we go with that. And maybe someone else can find that. Difficult to tell someone who's poured their heart and soul mm. into their product that they've got the best thing possible for mankind. And yet you're not going to sell it here. We have a brand of chocolate bars that we bring in, and they do extremely well. They're called Seattle Chocolate, and they're gorgeous truffle bars, and they're just doing really well. They have other lines of chocolate bars in the US that are premium to that, you know, I'm not sure how often you buy a $14 chocolate bar, Hayden. Is it very often?
No, not very often at all.
Probably never.
Yeah.
Right. And where yep. are you going to find one other than an airport gift shop potentially? Right. So yeah. again, there has to be an understanding about the opportunity for your brand, given its price point, to find a reasonably sizable, big enough market to be in. Mm. So I would be great if there was, a legitimate place for suppliers to go online and gather all this information. Like, what do I need to do beyond starting my own organization and managing all of that to actually get my product to market? And, you know, I haven't looked online. I'm sure there's a lot of resources, but I'm not able to, you know, tell you what those are. We kind of go through that process. And I would say, you know, to the credit of most suppliers, they've done some of that homework already. They have an idea where they're going. And I think the big surprise for them is cost of entry, cost of trade marketing participation, mm. and potentially entering the market as the most expensive entrant in that category. So if you decide to start importing your coffee beans and roasting them in your basement, saying, I've got the best coffee in the world now, but it's $20 for 454 grams, maybe someone will list you, but as soon as they have to dust it off, you're done and you've got all this coffee that you can't do anything with. So again, I come back to price. Price to me is really not that we don't sell. We sell really expensive stuff as a specialty goods distributor. Our stuff is premium and it's expensive, but there is a ceiling, and that ceiling really impacts your opportunity to participate in the market.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah. Rick, you've provided so much information today, mate. I hope for the listeners it's been an easy conversation, because I feel like at times, Rick, I haven't known exactly what question to ask you to tease out the information, but you've done an amazing job of like giving some amazing insight, and I feel as if I've learned so much from the conversation. So thanks for bearing with my limited amount of knowledge in the industry and what it is exactly that, you know, somebody has to endeavor upon to get listed with a distributor, and what that exactly means for them and the value that it can bring for them as well.
Well, thank you, Hayden. I wouldn't say you have a limited knowledge by any stretch of the imagination. I've known you for quite a long time, and you certainly know what you're talking about. And I think your podcast is a great idea. I hope it's helpful for somebody. I'm going to go back and probably be somewhat surprised to some of the answers I gave today. But at the end of the time, I hope I haven't misguided anyone. And I thank you for the opportunity. It's always great to see you.
Yeah, you too, Rick. I really appreciate it, mate. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Cheers. Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions from today's episode or would like to know more about what I can do to help you achieve your packaging vision, you can reach me directly at hayden@thepackheavypodcast.com. You could DM me on Instagram @thepackheavypodcast, or we could also connect on LinkedIn and start a conversation there. I'll see you next week.